Thanks, Fabrizio. So first of all, thank you very much for being with us this afternoon. I think it's great that a lot of people still get some energy to be with us after this busy day. I think this is the first time that we have created this open space to create. And we have retained for this afternoon four domains, four areas where I think we would like to capture your creativity, your attention, and your insights. So this is basically your space. And we are inviting everyone to be as expressive as possible, such a way that we can incorporate your comments or clarification or whatever, because we have also a few people from the EWG also attending this session. So this is really a space for all of you to be challenging us and being, at the end, hopefully more comfortable of what we have been put into this status report posted last November 11th. So with that, we have data, we have the model over there, we have validation, gated access, and we have privacy, of course, just behind me. So do we want to split ourselves around this four whiteboard, and then I'm sure we'll get also some staff people capable to record and to make sure that we keep track of everything which will be said. You mean discussing the after that?
No, well.
Yeah, I mean, you can position yourself into a one, or you can turn, or you can.
Okay.
Who wants to talk to you about stuff?
We're a small enough group, I just don't think.
I don't know.
It's a very small group.
It's very small, yeah.
Would the facilitators of each group like to just remind people what the groups will be addressing, and then we can ask people to go to the respective groups? Sure.
There is a problem that the groups will be so small that there's no dynamic. I mean, I would hate to be the only wallflower with nobody coming to my session, you know?
Also, I can staff. Is there a reason why the microphones are all flashing?
I touched one. Thank you. Because I touched it. So if we're going to do that, well, why don't we just put the board right here in the middle, each board, and or just one, and just put privacy and talk about privacy, and put another one up that, and we just split it up, and everyone can get their feedback into it, and then you get one or two scribes, and then run the hour that way.
And we'll be comfortable that we risk that because we're going to start with some, let's say, privacy or data or whatever. Then we are not going to finish in 1 hour.
So why don't we do this? If we have an hour, split it up evenly, and if people feel passionately after the moment has stopped for, say, privacy,
they
that
continue.
Board moves over, and you can continue, and we move on to the
next
subject.
Very good.
Sound good?
So you start by the what? Privacy?
Wouldn't it make more sense to start with data elements? Because then we'd understand what privacy meant.
For those who have wandered in, please have a seat. This is going to be a very interactive session.
I guess so.
For those who are joining remotely, you'll need to get into the Adobe chat room on your computers. We'll enter information in there so you can participate through the Adobe chat room.
If I pull the muscle carrying that over here, can I pile for some sort of
absolutely.
Yeah.
Hello?
Okay, so if we're starting with data, are we? Maybe I don't. Hi, I'm Susan from Facebook, and I've been part of the WHOIS review team and then signed on for the EWG. So it's an interesting experience with WHOIS, or new data records for domain names. So we just had a limited number of handouts, but I think it's really important, I think, you know, for myself at least, in viewing this as not a part of the EWG, to know what our thinking is on what's going to be in the data record, that what we're proposing at this moment at least. And so we have a handout there. I think page 63 is probably going to be your most interesting page. Because this is the minimum anonymous query response. So if I want to know what example.com, I think is the domain name, or example.tld, what the data anonymous, where I can anonymously pull the public data, so I don't have to do any validation, no login, no nothing, this is the data you'll get. So all of the registry data, all of the registrar data, but a very, very minute data elements from the registrant. And I know, Steve, you brought that up as you were, I can't remember how you put it, shocked that that's what we came up with for the anonymous. So in looking at that, is there a discussion around that?
I have a question here. She's like looking around, so I was waiting until she could see me. Hi, Pete Roman, U.S. Department of Justice. My question is, my memory of how WHOIS got started was that we were all trying to have contact information in case something went wrong, and the one thing you've completely excluded from the public access stuff is all of the contact information.
Well,
right? It's all here in gray at the bottom of page 62, and none of it's showing up in the public stuff. So if I'm just your random sysadmin and I have a problem and I want to contact the guy whose site keeps pinging me, I have to go to the registrar before I can actually go contact the guy?
So now, if you look at the bottom of page 64, actually, I may have, no, where is it? No, 63, excuse me. So if you look at the bottom of that, you're going to get the domain name. You'll get the name servers. The name servers will give you some sort of information. You'll get the registrant type. And then you will get a registrant contact ID and the registrant email address. So we had quite a discussion on what do you need to take care of a technical issue. And the email address is what we decided was probably the most important.
Why are you giving out the registrant's email, which might be really only intended for the registrar, as opposed to giving out the registrant's contact email, which was clearly intended to be used to contact him?
I guess I'm missing the distinction.
I think it is the registrant email, actually, in the bottom of page 63.
No, it says registrant email, but there's also a contact email on the bottom of page 62. Mm-hmm. In the contacts that we are not sharing is the contact email, which when I was doing this was mm-hmm. the contact email that I wanted you to contact me at. The registrant email was the contact info that I wanted the registrar to contact me at. So why am I sharing the stuff that I want the registrar to use with the whole world and not sharing the stuff that I want the whole world to use with the whole world?
Well, I would think we intended that this is the email address that you would want anyone to contact you at. And there's also...
Then why not use the contact email?
Can I jump in here? I think you have to use the contact info. Because the other email is protected under data protection legislation, so It's the contact info.
So, but then Lisa? If this is the contact info, you should probably fix it so it says it's the contact info.
So I think maybe what is lost when you just look at the example, sort of absent the description behind it, is that there's the concept of having role-based contacts. And the particular example you're looking at, the registrant is an individual and didn't provide role-based contacts, so the only thing you have is the registrant's email address. But we would think that the normal case would be that registrants would choose to provide a technical contact, an administrative contact, and they would default to public. Registrants could provide that information and ask that it be private, gated, if you will. But that if they chose to provide it by default, it would be public, particularly to enable contact, as you say.
So, for example, in my own domain management, I would put everything public, and I'd have that option. But for our company, the registrant, the admin contact, and technical contact is all the same, so there's no need to actually address all those roles. It's like if you want to know, here's the phone number, here's domain at FB, that comes to me, I then hand it out to or there are other people looking at domain at FB.com. But so we do envision that companies may have a different burden put on them, but this is just simply for an individual. So this is going to be the lightest weight of public access information you receive. Yes.
Thank you. I don't actually agree with got a friend over there.
Could you give your name, please?
Yeah, sure. Jay Daly from .nz. I think one of the problems we've always had is people misunderstanding the difference between the registrant details and the contact details. To me, the registrant details are not the contractual issue between the registrar and the registrant. They are the authority, record for the registry. And every registrar I know would have a different set of data about their relationship with the customer, and it's not going to bleed into this at all because they don't want it to. Right. So the registrant is the right thing to have here, as I understand it, in that type of way. The thing that I find slightly odd is the lack of address detail, postal details there, mm-hmm. because the implication is then that if you want to send somebody a formal notice like a cease and desist letter or something like that, you then have to use gated access for it.
Right.
And I believe that pushing you into gated access for that is not necessary.
Jay, just it's Michele speaking. Does this entire thing around gated public and gated, I think a lot of you may be laboring under the perception that gated automatically infers high level of validation of the person requesting access to data. That's not necessarily the case. As you most of you probably know, you do a Whois lookup from a command line. Whois client, you're not really sharing any of your own information. I mean, you have a certain degree of anonymity. Depending on the Whois server you hit up against, it may get an IP address, it may not. With the kind of lighter form of gating, it could simply be a question of you going to a web form. Maybe you might need to authenticate with something, but at a very, very light level. Not a quick case of, send in a blood sample and a copy of your driver's license and a check for $100,000 or anything. It's just the case of we, in inverted commas, will get more information about you, but not necessarily a huge amount.
Right.
If you're going to specify that, and you're going to say, right, this is the level of gating that's required to get access to that, mm-hmm. and that's then going to be properly policed afterwards, then I could probably live with that. Okay.
And that'll be up next.
But it sounds to me as though that gating there that you've just described, you enter a capture or something like that, is actually just about controlling people, taking too much data. Looking up too many things, and that doesn't need to be done at the client end. You can do that at the server end.
Well, we haven't really come to terms with what that gate is yet or what the access to get through the gate is yet, to be honest. So I think you would, I think at this point we would have varying opinions on that, but letting us know what you think would be good for the validation would be interesting. Was there a gentleman over here? Or?
I was just going to say, I mean, the basic premise we're having here is that if Joe Blow consumer wants to just quickly check, is this a person, a company, wants to write an email like, hey, did you know your website is down or something bad's going on? What registrar you are, kind of system-generated data, that's not highly sensitive information. So if you just want to have a quick talk with somebody but if you want to get beyond that, like a home address or something like that, as Michaela was saying, there just needs to be an extra level so that we know that you're not just kind of randomly seeing things that you could misuse without giving anything about yourself. So in my instance, to send a cease and desist letter, I mean, I would be more than happy to send it. If the rules are set up, I'd be more than happy to send it via email, especially if it's known that that email is tied to, if you don't answer or you don't do anything or it's invalid or it bounces, it's also tied to the RAA. But I also would have no problem doing something like Michaela said, whereas I do want the address. I have no problem saying, hi, I'm Fabricio, lawyer for Time Warner, and I'm going to send you a letter. Give me that info. But I do think that you're hitting right on the spot. I think that there's a balancing act here on the validation, and I think that's what's probably what was getting to Steve earlier as well, is there is a danger that can over-rotate in a wrong way, and we need to just strike the balance on that.
Can I just say then that I think that the registrant type should determine the default public data that is provided then, because a legal person is very different from a company in that regard, and publishing a company's address...
Correct.
And my understanding of my data in my registry is that it is largely corporate addresses and organizational addresses, and I think that's the way that people use Whois data a lot, is for those organizational addresses.
We agreed with you, and actually we had a full discussion almost days about between how you could do commercial, non-commercial, corporate or not corporate. So one of the things that we actually discussed was explaining very explicitly, as you go through the registration flow, this is kind of your basic data that will go out. This is the stuff you fill in, and by the way, there would be a way that you could check and say, make this all public. It's, and then why is the benefit of this? And we would actually say, as a company, you may want to actually show all this information so people know exactly who you're dealing with and can contact you, et cetera, et cetera.
But we also could decide that as a company, you do not have the rights that an individual does anywhere.
That's the point I think
so
you very much need to make.
Therefore, you will, once we, I have talked about a bright line in the past.
Yeah.
You've stepped over that bright line to, yes, you are a commercial enterprise of some sort. You may be acting in your own name doing that, but by doing that, then your address and other data elements
because
would be
of
shown.
Consumer protection, effectively.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Right.
I'm conscious of the time and the other three areas, so if we could quickly hear from people who are not on the working group, then we're going to have to. No, it's been a really useful discussion then. Yeah.
Okay. I think Michael was.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. So I would agree with mostly everything that Jay had just articulated with regard to the concerns, and then after hearing what you said, addressing some of those fears. So my suggestion to the working group, if you want to conclude your 3-month volunteer service, hopefully by Singapore, perhaps if you could articulate in the near future what that gating would look like, because with not knowing what that gating function is going to look like, if this is the complexity of signing up for, say, a Google Gmail account or a Facebook page, something that can be that simple, I think that would go a long way towards addressing the fears as Michaela or Steve was articulating. And that will help, I think, further focus the work and the comments and allow you guys to finish up.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, Steve Metallitz. My question really was about something. This example on page 63 is a registration by a legal person, and I thought you said that there would be the rules would be different for registrations by legal persons. But this is the one that
that's a little confusing to me too. And that may Lisa can
We have a comment from the chat that we need to introduce. Sorry.
So I am viewing this, and this is something we've sort of that's an individual.
Okay. So. Well, I do have a question about how that data element will be validated. I don't know if this is the appropriate time to raise
an individual
that.
Or a
registrant type.
Yes, we haven't gone there.
Okay.
I'm sorry for not having all the answers,
yeah.
But it's.
I would suggest this is going to be the most difficult data element of all to evaluate.
I would agree.
And I think you should seriously consider whether you need this data element because it's a big validation problem.
So we've also thought about self-selecting. So there was a comment over here. Yeah.
Tim Chen from Dementals. Just on the data, the original registration date is optional gray elements are optional to collect. So are you saying that there may not be the original registration date listed in the WHIS record anymore?
So, no. The creation date would always be in the record. The original creation date was something that I use extensively in my work day-to-day. So the original creation date may have been, say, a domain was registered in 2000, deleted in 2002, and created again in 2003. It's very helpful to know that it was registered in 2000 to start, mm-hmm. or maybe it was registered every 2 years because it just deletes and continues to be picked up again. That just so the original creation date is something you can get a WHOIS history. Michael did point out today in the earlier session that that's not always accurate because of some transition issues early on. So.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, so that may not be if the registrar can choose not to make that. Or the registrant, maybe. I guess it must be the registrar. The registrant's not going to know that, right?
Yeah.
So this has to come from the system.
Right. And it may not be available even.
Okay.
Or it doesn't exist because the creation and the original creation date was. Okay, we have somebody in the.
Yeah, this is Alice Johnson voicing Kathy Kleiman's comment in the Adobe Connect room. Many legal persons are protected in many countries, including minority groups, political groups, religious groups, often incorporated.
And I think that goes to the local jurisdictions, that discussion. So,
just one thing, some of the stuff we're not 100% locked down on. I mean,
yep.
This is why we're having these conversations, because we know, how can I put this? We know that what's currently there is not helping a lot of people. It doesn't, nobody's particularly happy with it. Whether you're a registrar, registrant, registry, law enforcement, brand, privacy advocate, whatever. You've all got issues with it. There's some complexities, like the jurisdictional thing is one which is causing us massive headaches. The gating, the registrant type. We're not 100% sure what the best way is to deal with some of these things, so we're looking for the feedback. We're trying to get some input from people. So, the contribution from Jay, that's really helpful.
Yep, pick us apart.
So, may I suggest, since we're approaching 5 o'clock, that we take one more comment on this, and then I think a natural segue is validation and gated access. And I want to remind people who have wandered in late, this is an interactive session, so feel free to join us at the table here and share your perspective. Also, we don't actually have a hard stop, and there's nothing else scheduled in this room, so we're happy to hang out longer and talk this evening if you'd like.
Is there another question on this side? Yeah, okay. Sorry, stepped on you there.
So, Jim Galvin, I have a question, a slightly different question to ask about data elements. I'm sitting here looking and seeing the examples. I'm wondering if the working group is going to speak to the issue of translating data or transliterating the data elements at all.
Yes.
And one thing that I would call out is I'm remembering back 2 years ago, right, the Internationalized Registration Data Working Group had made the statement that registrants should not be expected to use anything other than their own local language or script. And then, of course, in all of these nice display examples here, it then begs the question of, well, what happens between whatever form it comes in? Will you speak to that question and affirm that recommendation or say something different? And then will you speak to what happens on the display side? Should I take whatever's in, or should I plan to be doing something else?
Don't think we've covered that completely.
So if I may.
Yes.
Scott Hollenbeck from VeriSign, who is also quite active in the IETF Weirds group addressing this effort, has, along with ICANN staff Steve Sheng, has briefed the expert working group a few times, and we have incorporated some discussion into our work. Obviously, though, you know, we aren't there yet, and I think one of the outstanding issues the group needs to discuss further is to what extent and how we're going to incorporate that work in the final report, which we're targeting for release around the Singapore meeting next March, April.
If I may, then, just for completeness, I mean, there are obviously two other working groups that would, you know, feed into the answering those questions. There's the expert working group looking at the requirements for internationalized registration data, which is supposed to also specify a data model for the data. So there's a relationship there in that. And then, of course, the GNSO. I haven't actually checked their agenda today, but in theory they approved a working group, and I'm getting some nodding heads, so they did, on asking the questions that had been put forth, again, by the IRD working group from 2 years ago about translation and transliteration. And the specific questions are, will there be a common language? And if there's to be translation or transliteration, who should do it? So, you know, those are things to keep in mind, and I'd very much like for this group to consider and say something about this issue in your final report. That'd be very much appreciated. Thank you.
I'm just going to read something from remote for Scott. Lisa was going to, but whatever. Scott Hollenbeck on remote is just saying that RDAP can certainly accommodate both localized and ASCII-only representations.
Right. My concern is not about the protocol that's under development in WEIRDS, as I'm sure Scott very well knows. It's more about what the rest of the system is going to do, because the WEIRDS, the RDAP protocol and WEIRDS behind it will take care of whatever's on the back end. So, thank you.
Okay. Rod Rasmussen, another EWG member. I'm going to talk about validation and gated access, which the gated access we've already been talking about. So I think we can get most of that pretty quick. And on that last point that Jim was raising, I think, you know, we have talked about this a bit. I think in general, although we haven't really gotten down to it yet, but in general, that's going to fall into one of those principles that we're going to suggest that the model and the way that the system is configured and policies around it conform kind of with whatever the other policies that come out of those other groups are. We don't want to try and, you know, boil the whole ocean around all the other sub-policies on this, but that is an important point as to what are you going to display and all that from various, you know, international formats. On the validation, I'm going to hold the validation for a second because we've been talking about gated access a bit. The gated access and the data elements go hand in hand, and it's hard to extricate those two different areas because the gated access implies that some data elements are available under some rules apply to getting those, and others they don't. I think that in our conversations, we're envisioning almost, you know, what I would call three layers. One's the public, anonymous, anybody can look at it at any time. All there is some auditing around numbers of requests that are coming in. There's this idea of a light form of access, where basically you're providing information about yourself as a requester, but there's not an accreditation needed to get that level of data. And then there's a third level, which would be the highly sensitive data, depending on which buckets those fall into. And that's obviously where we'll get feedback on from the community as well, because we're trying to figure out what levels are what, where you would need some sort of credentials and, you know, validation of those credentials in order to get it, an accreditation of some sort. So that's the kind of the three-tier model, if you can think of it that way. Also would note that on this there is certainly the possibility, in fact, it's going to be required for automation of being able to pull data. I had a couple of people talk to me in the last couple of days about I'm looking up 50,000 domain names a day because that's how many fake pharma sites there are out there, and we need to figure out what's going on with them, because there's way more than that probably even registered per day just for
illicit pharmacy. So you would have some sort of keying or some sort of automation that would allow for that. I know that's been a question a couple of people have asked, so I figured I'd throw that out there as part of this process. So looking for the other side of the gated access point is actually providing some sort of credentialing system, some sort of access system for being able to get at that. So if we had comments on that, and then I want to talk about the validation scheme, which gets into the contact management part of it. But I want to get the gated access stuff out of the way first. Jay.
Thank you. I think in the gated access, it would be good for you to remember that data is currency. And that if you are asking, if anybody is asking someone for data that can be separated from the idea of credentials, then they're effectively asking you to pay. And so it would be nice if there were fairly strict limits on what could be asked for the purpose of providing credentials and validation, rather than just a data harvesting exercise.
What exercise?
Sorry, data harvesting exercise.
Got it. So that's really kind of a terms of use and et cetera, or terms of reuse, et cetera, right?
It's the terms under which people provide gated access so that they're not using it for much more than they should be using it for.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay, and that goes right into our principles of purpose-based, purpose-driven, And obviously you need a compliance regime around that of some sort if you have people abusing their access privileges to get through the gate to get information, if they're turning around and doing something that's not to purpose. There need to be some sort of a compliance around that.
I'm talking about the people who run the gate.
Right.
That they shouldn't be abusing their position in running the gate asking for more data than they need for the purpose, very narrow, specific purpose of doing that.
Right, okay. Or providing it or whatever, depending on the model. Right, okay. I'm supposed to write this down, okay. Okay, any other comments on the gated access side of this? Or questions or thoughts? Steve.
Steve Metallitz. Yeah, I'm still having a little trouble understanding if the step up to gated access, in other words, to getting the credential is very, very minimal, then what is the significance really of having such a limited set of data for the general public? And if it's very high, if the step up is very high, then I think that this is what people have a concern about. And I'm sort of hearing different things about how high and it might. And Jay's point too that maybe it will be used, it will be exploited in other ways. But I guess I'm just agreeing with those who said it is important to try to pin this down a little bit because it helps to put some of the rest of it in perspective.
Yeah, so as I was talking about, it's not just one step, but potentially two steps, right? So there's a low step and then a higher step, depending on that. Okay. I'm not sure who was first, Wendy or Steph. Wendy? She's not on the group, so we should get. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks. Wendy Seltzer. So I'm just wondering whether you considered sort of symmetries in the types of error that could be made. So you've got inaccuracy in providing data as a registrant, you've got inaccuracy in providing data as a requester of entry through the gate. Are there similar penalties for those who make the errors or willful inaccuracies and similar liabilities on those who allow them to do that, and in which ways do those errors sort of trend?
Right. Important. We have been thinking about it. We haven't figured out what the scale looks like yet, though, right? But certainly that's part of our discussions and part of the work going forward. Was there input from?
Yeah, we have a comment here from Kathy Kleiman. About gate is that access, and shouldn't there be multiple gates or tiers of access depending on the sensitivity of the data? And I believe that actually is the proposal.
Yeah, yes.
I jump in here, Rod? That was basically the point I was going to make, is it's important to clarify that gate is kind of the wrong word. Nobody likes tier, but gate implies like there's a gate into a fairground. In actual fact, what you're really doing is figuring out the purpose for which you're restricting different fields of data. And, you know, there's a lot of purposes there. It's to stop bulk harvesting. It's to stop abuse. It's to protect personal information. It's to protect sensitive information, yada, yada, yada.
Jay?
Thank you. I think it's also important for you to remember that this is the internet and not the subset of it called the web. Okay, so I gate access to our whois, always have done. It's called rate limiting and whitelisting. And the purpose for doing that is to prevent bulk data extraction. And so we, you know, we mustn't always think it's a web form in that type of thing. There are plenty of other ways to do it.
Yeah, that's actually been one of my big points that I've been making all along. I look at most access as probably be on an automated basis when you look at just the sheer number of lookups. But it has to be then with some sort of purpose and some sort of credentials and all that kind of stuff, depending on what it is. You can put it. Sure.
Sorry,
that
Rod.
It's not just the web for getting data.
Yeah. Sorry, Rod, just to say, for us, the credentials we need at some times are just an IP address.
Mm-hmm.
That's the very minimum set of credentials,
right.
And it's a simpler one. And I just think we don't need to over-engineer the credentials required sometimes.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, just Jay, that's one of the things that we've agreed on as well. I mean, it's a bit like that idea of, you know, the cost, in inverted commas, doesn't have to be economic. It's just you give us a bit of your data in return for us giving you access to data.
If I could just add one comment, building on what Stephanie said and whether gate is the right word, I think actually that badge that gets you through gate is the analogy that we've used a few times in the EWG. You know, the badge identifies who you are in certain respects. It also possibly identifies where you can go once you get through the big entrance gate, and then you're looking at the individual data elements, the individual areas that you're able to go to, and what you went through to get the badge to some extent determines the level of clearance once you get through the gate.
Steve?
I guess this raises just a general question about how we should read this status report. I do recall the tiered access, although no one wanted to call it that, concept in the original report. I don't see it in the status report. Every example is given and suggests a binary system, I think. You have two examples. You have the one on page 64 of what the public gets, and you have one what the authenticated user gets. So I see two examples. I don't think there's any reference. Anyway, my question is, should we be assuming that anything that isn't addressed or contradicted in the by the status report that was in the initial report remains valid? I'm just trying to put these pieces together so we understand what the whole picture looks like.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Anybody disagree on the group with that? Okay. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there could be a gray area here and there, but I think for the most part.
The thing is, we're not... What we're trying to do in the update is to go into more detail about elements that people said we'd glossed over in the initial report, and to give you a better understanding of how we came up with what we came up with. Because, you know, the reality is that most members of the group have spent, I mean, I don't know how many hours at this stage. I mean, we've had multiple face-to-face meetings. We've had two-day meetings that actually became four-day meetings. We've had multiple phone calls. I don't know how many hundred emails have been swapped. There's been subgroup calls and sub-sub-subgroup calls. There's been dinners where you push the plates to one side. You know, it goes on.
Move along.
So we're not, stuff is not set in stone.
We're reliving it right now.
This is to voice a comment from Kathy Kleiman. Can you talk about the difference of access for two specific groups, e.g. intellectual property and law enforcement?
We are envisioning having credentials or access be differentiated for those two communities. The exact data elements that each would get under which circumstances haven't been nailed down, but we would look at those as different accreditation schemes and potentially different levels of access of information, because you may not need the same data elements in order to do an intellectual property type of action versus a law enforcement sort of action.
the exact differences, that's what we're debating, and if you have input into that, that's great.
So, hi, this is Karen from Merck Monitor. I think that those questions, while really interesting and very important, are super premature at this point. I think that, you know, the expert working group, as far as I know, and you guys have been working for a lot longer than 90 days from February, was to present kind of a framework through which we were supposed to then discuss this as a community through the policy development process and through the implementation process. And those kinds of details, I think, very much belong in the hands of the ICANN community through a structured discussion in the PDP process, which we're, you know, improving through a PDP process. But I think that this will all, you know, be shaken out, and it shouldn't just be coming from the expert working group. Although, obviously, your input is extremely valuable through that as well. Yeah. Thanks.
And that raises an important, just overall, for this is for all aspects of what we're doing, and that's very true. And then what we're trying to do is, though, make sure that we provide enough detail so that the PDP doesn't get bogged down in some of the areas it has before. So some guidance there. And, yeah, we know that not everything that we suggest is going to get adopted. We'll live. It's okay. But at the same time, we want to try to get as far as we can along the process to give you as much input from our, you know, kind of coalescing and working as long as we have on it to come up with some things that will work. Peter, you had your hand up for quite a while.
Thanks. One of the things that, and we've talked, Rod and I talked about this earlier, that law enforcement would be concerned with the gated access is the possibility of tracking what we're doing. Law enforcement in general would prefer that we not be tracked pretty much in any way. We don't want, there are issues there not just with what you guys learn about our investigations, but the possibility that somebody, a bad guy, gains access to it and now suddenly knows everybody that we're investigating, how that investigation is going, who we've talked to, who we're looking at. I don't know what your plan is in terms of tracking. I know there's some discussion about being able to audit users' access and what they do with it and whether they're using it legitimately, and I understand that, and I can see why you would want to do that. But I have to say that we on this end would be really concerned if you're keeping lots and lots of very specific information about what it is that we're doing. This is the exact same conversation I had with the domain tools guys earlier, too. So,
can I respond to that? That's a well-known problem in data protection legislation. And so, in my view, it would be easy enough to codify which types of requests require secrecy and which ones don't. How you do that technically, that I'm over to Rod. But I think with proper consultation, that's an easy enough problem to fix. I don't think you're suggesting that the dog catcher's entitled to secrecy. Yeah.
This is to read a comment from Monica in the Adobe Connect room. How could jurisdictions, governments agree on who should have access to what level of data under which conditions? Do you think you can find a global solution? Why not focus on connection via Whois for technical problems and leave all the storage and access stuff to the different jurisdictions?
Duly noted, I guess. Thank you. That's input.
Hi, Tim Chen from Domain Tools. Rod, I apologize. I have not read the entire 84-page document, although I hear it's outstanding. I will.
Come on, catch up.
Yeah. So I apologize.
A long plane, right?
Believe it or not, I have not been to all the Whois meetings either. So if this has been asked, then I apologize. Was there been a discussion about higher volume access to the data? Because some of the information in Whois is useful only if you do more than one at a time lookups.
Yes. And actually, it was just addressing that
you are.
A few minutes ago.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
I missed
yeah.
it.
No worries. Yeah, and that okay. we fully envision the bulk of them, if you count the most number of lookups, will probably be automated. So the credentials need to
from within
that.
The gated environment.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is to read two comments that we've received in the Adobe Connect room. The first one is from John Horton. Thanks a lot to the expert working group for the hard work you've put in on this issue, and sorry that I cannot be there in person. I'm interested in the expert working group's thoughts on a couple of questions that relate to general principles as opposed to implementation details. First pertains to what I think is a presumption that anonymous access to Whois leads to a mining and abusing, quoting from the PowerPoint. Is that based on any empirical data, or is that more anecdotal in nature? I'd be interested in better understanding the extent to which bulk data extraction for abusive purposes has been documented and what those abuses have concretely been. Second, has there been any discussion about balancing out registrants' right to privacy and internet users' right to know who operates a website, where the registrant is located, and so forth? Put a different way, do folks on the Expoken group feel that internet users have a right to know who has registered a domain name, or is there no such right? Thanks. Second comment is from Kathy Kleiman. Could we hear more about the privacy?
The second point, yes, is the quick answer.
I'll speak very briefly to John. Hi, John. It's Michele speaking. The bulk anonymous access to who is definitely does lead to mining. We've had multiple incidents reported to us where a domain name that was registered on, say, a Friday using a specially created email address, and the registrant starts getting spammed within, 48, 72 hours. And in some cases, the spams are actually pretty vicious. We're talking about fake renewal notices, phishing attacks, all that kind of thing. So it's not purely anecdotal, and I know that there is work has been done. Maybe Lisa or others might be able to speak to that.
Yeah, if I could just mention very shortly the results of the Who Is Misuse study, which has been underway for forever, will come out, and they found very strong correlation between anti-harvesting mechanisms that they tested and the level of misuse.
And we may or may not have been privy to some of that data to inform our decisions here. We're running way behind. Yeah.
So you have one more comment? Can I jump back to Kathy's question? Kathy Kleiman's question was, could we hear more about the privacy and jurisdictional issues that are being debated?
Okay, well, that'll be under the privacy area. That's up next. And so we get that board up here. My own pet project is the whole validation stuff, and which we didn't really get to. That's around what I would really like people to comment on and come give us input or give track me down to talk about this concept of individuals or individual organizations having control over their contact information, and really creating, if you take a look at what we're proposing here, almost a parallel system where you're actually registering contact data separately from domain name registrations. So you have the concept of you as an individual or as an organization control your information, update your information using a validator of some sort that then is tied to domain name registrations. And that's a really important big concept in order, it's a big change we're talking about here potentially, and how this is managed. Now, the good news is the EPP and everything was set up to do that, because way back in the day, that's actually how it was managed. And so the back-end systems can actually handle this pretty easily, and a lot of the registrars actually have this in place. Anyways, that is an important concept to actually get.
Just bear in mind that Rod at times does not speak for the entire EWG when he makes certain statements.
I mean, it is a work in progress.
It is a work in progress. I mean, this is part of, again, your feedback, your input on a lot of this stuff, it's helpful. I mean, we may have a lot of expertise, a lot of knowledge, but we need your input.
I need to jump in here and cut Michele off before we hear about the Irish postal system and how difficult it is to validate. So I think we're going to trot through this fairly quickly, but we will be hanging around, so please hang around with us if you're interested in going on further, but I'll try and stick to my 15 minutes. There is a section in here, and we passed around these documents on the privacy chunk as far as they would go. I think we only had about 10 copies, so they didn't quite, so please share. The first element in this, and basically, as I said the other day, there's four kind of areas where we looked at privacy implications. There's obviously application of applicable law in the different jurisdictions. There is binding corporate rules, which is basically a privacy policy that we have made a commitment to. There is improvements in the privacy and proxy services, which we would prefer to call shielding and proxy services. And there is a secure protected credential
for individuals and groups that are under threat. So those are, and of course, a key element in this whole accreditation system is the notion that people don't have an untrammeled right to get at your data. So that's a privacy protection in itself. Okay. Are there people around the table who understand what we mean by binding corporate rules, other than the ones that have heard me go on about them already? No. Okay. So I think it probably is worthwhile spending a bit of time. It's not the most accessible concept in international data protection, but those who are familiar with the European Framework for Data Protection know that there is a provision there that you're not supposed to export data outside the legal framework in the community to jurisdictions that do not have adequate data protection. Global corporations, and I cite Hewlett-Packard just because it's one of the many that have operations in many jurisdictions, they've signed on to binding corporate rules, so have people like Shell and Rabobank. Basically what it does is come up with a set of management practices that meets a high level of data protection. You select a data protection regime within the European community. You take your set of management practices or privacy policies and procedures to that data protection commissioner. They approve the policy set of procedures. And then that is accepted by the Article 29 Working Party for Data Protection within the Union. That means then you don't have to go to a data commissioner every time you export data. You're more or less accepted to be meeting that standard. That, in my view, would be a dandy thing for ICANN, if it's interested in public policy obligations, to sign on to binding corporate rules. However, our remit is only the RDS, whatever you call it. So we can focus on the RDS and cover data transfers through the central repository to jurisdictions where there isn't data protection. Okay? And that this partially answers that rather long question that came in a minute ago that someone said duly noted to. I mean, one of the problems of, and one of the reasons why I support a central model, is it's way easier to handle these kinds of issues if you have it in one place. And you can set high standards and have management practices that you can have a hope of covering. So, anybody got any questions on the binding corporate rules? I have to say that they might not be accepted by a data commissioner within the union, because if you're trying to take only a piece of all of your corporate practices, that might not pass muster. But in any case, it wouldn't hurt to have the practices. Steve.
Yes, I was just trying to understand if there, who is the corporation that you would be referring to in this case? Is it ICANN or is it the registry? And on whom would it be binding?
Well, it would have to be ICANN setting the policy, and that would be enforced through contract, which makes the binding corporate rules concept real lumpy, doesn't really work well. Depending, there's debate here, and you're not going to find out until you go to the Article 29 group and get an opinion. There's debate over whether ICANN is a data controller or whether it's not. Michaeli and I fight about this all the time. I think it's a data controller because it sets policy. It sets policy which it obliges people to do observe through contract. RAA, you're setting policy when you set all those things in the contract. So if you check on the Article 29 website, you will see a long document about what it means to be a controller and what it means. They did this in the context of the new review that's going on right now. And I'm pretty sure we fall within controller, we being ICANN. So I don't think ICANN can turn around and say, you, all you lot out there in the ecosystem, you all have to have binding corporate rules. I think that would be a bit of a reach.
But if I understand you correctly, you're saying that ICANN already has binding corporate rules because it does set...
Well, no.
Well,
no.
Let me finish. It does set the policies that all of the registries and registrars have to follow. The piece that's missing is it hasn't gotten those policies blessed by the appropriate data protection commissioner in one continent that needs to approve them for them to be binding corporate rules under the European definition. Is that the main difference?
I guess the reason why I immediately said no was I think you're right insofar as we are enacting policy by creating requirements, but we have not stated the policy. And that's why I think it's high time ICANN stated the policy. When it gets into these intractable arguments with the Article 29 group, it's usually because they're saying, what's your purpose? And we haven't stated the purpose. So in the RAA agreement, the data retention requirement only works if you've already stated that you are going to collect, use, and retain information for the purposes of law enforcement, which hasn't been stated. So I'm begging for a statement of policy. Anyway.
And that was discussed in the WHOIS review team, which I see Susan raising her hand. But I think I understand what the distinction is now.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely not. No.
So this has not been agreed upon, and it may be the RDS that would be have the binding corporate rules. You know, that's up for discussion. Yeah.
Wendy?
Yeah, I'm not deeply familiar with this idea, but I like it, what I've heard of it, as a way of putting some enforcement on the side of privacy, that there's a great imbalance here in the compliance that we've seen demanded of ICANN so far has been compliance coming down on registrars for data inaccuracies or for failures to complete enough of the WHOIS reveal information, and we need corresponding pressures to protect the information that registrants are demanding, rightfully demanding privacy for. So giving them a means where the harmed individual isn't the only one who can demand redress, but that there is some corporate compliance and audit function watching to make sure that that privacy is protected adequately. I think is important for individuals' privacy and important for ICANN's compliance with international law.
Okay. Carlton?
Yeah, I just want to add one thing. It's very important to understand that you have to have something like that to scale. When you're moving from 20-something GTLD to close to 2,000,
yeah,
you really need a different framework so that it scales. And that is one of the reasons why this is so important. You're quite right. We are expanding the compliance arena, and you have to have some kind of framework that scales from this 20-something, which is very drafty, we know, to something that is a lot more useful for a 2,000 kind of GTLD in the space and taking on more issues to make it better.
Okay. Failing any other comments on that one, I'm proposing for the purposes of time, because there's a very lengthy discussion of the privacy and proxy services in the actual document that was handed out. I don't think it's new ground for people because they've heard it before. And there is a PDP starting on the privacy proxy services. We were preferring to call them shielded to be a little more precise about what the service gives you and who's responsible for what. But the important things are that if you're using a proxy service, it's the proxy data that goes in the RDS. If you're using a shield service, your real information would be in the RDS. It just wouldn't be released. Have I got that right, folks? Yeah. Okay, good. Moving along to the next concept, which is the secure anonymous credentials.
Sorry,
we did talk.
Sorry, so you're not allowing any discussion about the privacy?
Oh, certainly. Go ahead.
Okay, lovely. All right. So, two things then. It's very common for corporates to use their lawyers to do, you know, to register a domain name with, okay, for the initial bit of a product launch or something like that. What's your expectation there that those lawyers need to register to become proxy service providers, or that they don't use lawyers, or that carries on? Is there a, you know, is there a way people can game things there? Because I think it's extremely unlikely that every law firm can do this, and there are lots of small law firms that have difficulty doing that.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn here, so let me know if either one of you think, yes. So the whole purpose to all this, right, is this baseline of accountability and contactability. Yep. And so when we've talked about this issue of a lawyer coming in or an agent coming in and registering for you, their information would all be there. They would be contactable. But the issue is that they would also be responsible.
Yeah.
And so the reason that someone might go to, I'm assuming a lawyer would take responsibility for his client or reveal, but that wouldn't be the case for my friend who signs up for me. They probably wouldn't have the same interaction as an attorney-client privilege. So that's why someone would use a shield or anonymous access instead.
I understand the difference.
But it would be very clear that if you've put your name in there, that you are responsible.
Okay, so it's understood that lawyers will continue to keep doing that. They won't need to become proxy service providers. And there's, you know, no chance of gaming or problems going on there.
I think that that's what we would agree on, because there's enough safeguard there.
Right, okay, great. Can I go on to the next bit?
Can I just put in caveat that my problem with this is that it's really a question of fairness. Lawyers will invoke solicitor-client privilege and not reveal any details about their client. Others who can't afford that won't have that. Carry on.
Okay, and what's the implication of that for this?
The implication is that if you want to be fully protected, you hire a lawyer, because...
Right. Okay, right. So the second is, have you got any plans about the separation of roles here between people who are going to be proxy service providers and registrars, and people who default as a registrar to also giving you the proxy service or anything? I mean, you know, is there a potential there for people to start creating a registrar that is going to, say, be favoured by particular types of users of domain names because of the way they operate proxy service at the same time?
If I understand the question, I think some of this stuff is going to be thrashed out in that PDP on proxy and privacy accreditation.
Okay.
I mean, the situation at the moment is that if you are a registrar and you have not signed the 2013 RAA, and you run or provide a proxy or privacy service or whatever the hell you want to call it, you can do so however the hell you wish. There are no binding rules. There's no binding policy of any description whatsoever. Once you sign on to the 2013 RAA and the proxy privacy service is run by a company affiliated with the ICANN accredited registrar, you have to follow some rules, which is kind of light. And then there's the PDP that's starting up now, which is having its first meeting tomorrow morning. I think it's at 8:30 or
8
o'clock. Okay. Oh, God, who schedules these things? Maybe you come along to that, Jay.
Possibly. My question, it may not be for the PDP, was specifically about the interaction between a registrar and a proxy service provider when they're under the same organisational control, and if there is a risk analysis to see whether there are any issues that could come from that.
That's an excellent point, and we'll note that, because when we do that risk and impact assessment, we might have a view on that. Have to figure that out. Thank you. Just want to underline that one of the purposes of us putting this in the report is it comes under the accountability. We want more accountability. Obviously, the group is going to be looking at this, but in our view, this will give us accountability so that we can de-accredit the proxy service providers. Okay, now in terms of secure protected credentials, there is a rather large piece in the report here, starting on page 41. And the concept here is that there are certain parties who need privacy for various reasons, because they, if they operate a domain name and their address is address, phone number, personal data are revealed by an unsuspecting registrar, they could suffer harm. So the first example we give is religious minorities. The second example is, it's called domestic abuse, but it's really individuals whose countries have given them a change of identity, and many Western countries do that for various purposes. People who would suffer harm if people found out where they were. Political speech is obviously one of the more difficult ones if you're operating in the global situation that we're operating in. Ethnic or other social groups that are subject to harassment, and journalists operating in war zones or hostile territory. There are certainly other groups. Clearly, Doctors Without Borders are getting in trouble these days, so, you know, we would have to entertain that. We decided that we should at least explore some of the basic pieces of this that need to be put together. The credentials are the easiest thing. The secure credentials that are on the market, there is now kind of an inspector function, or what you might call a backdoor, that has been built in, so that eventually you could, if there were sufficient abuse of a use of secure credentials, they could be opened up. But the point is that they would not be openable within the ICANN ecosystem, so that it would remove the potential for the personal data to be revealed by an unsuspecting registrar when, for example, a dangerous spouse comes after, suspecting that a domain's being operated by an ex-spouse. So this puts it outside that system. It's a big overload, but it solves one end of the privacy problem. So any questions on this? Everybody loves it. Nothing from law enforcement on this? No? Okay. Wonderful. Sold. Sold. We're out of time. Any last questions on privacy? Jolly good.
And just reiterating, I sound like a broken record, you know, if you want to give us input, there's plenty of ways to do so. And we did try to address as much of the input we'd received to date in the update.
All right, so we're going to discuss the model. For those of you who were in the earlier session, sorry for the redundancy here in that. I'll just explain. Obviously, in our initial report, we put out a proposal for an aggregated system. That system would have followed generally this model. Registrant would give his information to registrar. Registrar would then take that information, give it to registry. Registry would then, on a periodic basis, all registries, put that data up to an aggregated RDS. And all queries for information of who is, either anonymous or validated, verified, would just be between the user, requester, and the RDS. The RDS would not go back to registries for information. After receiving a lot of comment, both, have to say, in support and some questioning an aggregated model, so we had heavy on both sides, we did a lot more thinking, and the thinking really was around how do we address some of the concerns around aggregating data while still maintaining some of the benefits of having aggregated data. So obviously when you aggregate the data, you can create unified policies around, say, privacy, protection, uniformity of display, validation, et cetera, and that's a very valuable thing that we didn't want to just walk away from because they're great concepts for the system. So what we talked about, it's detailed very heavily in the report, but just a high level, obviously we've gone through many models, but the two that have kind of remained in our report are this aggregated that we initially came out with, and after analyzing six models, including the aggregated, again, we came out with a federated model. Now the difference there is the data goes all the way from registrant to registrar to registry, just as we have today in Thick Whois, and which will inevitably be across the board for everybody. That data then isn't duplicated up to the aggregated or the, you know, the RDS. What will happen is requestor will go to the RDS, make a request, and the RDS will actually go real time and be able to ping across registries for data. And so the main difference is, in some respects, think of it this way, it solves a lot of issues about jurisdictional concerns, where data sits. It solves a lot of issues around aggregating the data and housing it in one spot, while still hopefully maintaining a lot of the benefits of having requesters only going to one place, being able to put in certain policies and principles in place without having to accumulate all the data in one spot. So we wanted to open that up for discussion and see if people still had concerns, thought of ideas or tweaks around these two concepts, kind of open the floor up. And if you have another idea, by all means, feel free to tell us. And just keep in mind, whatever comments you make stand between me and beer. And that can be on the record. So, well, you're buying the first one.
No problem. I had enough of it last night. Can I just double check that you are seeing these as an either or and not considering a joint model of the two of them?
So explain, I mean, how would you join
the two? So each of these has different characteristics that support different uses. So if you're a law enforcement and you're worried about being tracked, then the aggregated data model is better for you because there'll be a single place that needs to be controlled, audited, and things like that. Okay. If you're anyone other than law enforcement, probably, then the other model, federated, is going to be better for those providing it because they'll feel they're under better control of it, and they're also less worried about who else is seeing the data about what's being accessed there. Okay.
Well, no, so... it's in the documents they just circulated, correct?
Yeah.
The models? No, because you would, the only really difference is that data copied into aggregate?
Yep.
Not that you don't have access to it or that people see different things.
No. Okay. All right. If I am running one of these, then I would like to know who is looking at it, and I would like to be able to track them, unless they were people who shouldn't be tracked, like law enforcement, okay? And so it would potentially suit that you had both models where different classes of usage use a different type of model, so that law enforcement use the aggregated data one, which has operated under a certain set of, you know, priorities that ensure that there was no tracking taking place, and everybody else used the local federated one, which could be tracked and other things could be done with that.
So you're basically saying make a copy for that highly verified...
I'm not actually saying that. I want to know if you're considering that as a possibility.
We hadn't.
Model across those, right?
Okay. We hadn't.
Okay. Because actually there's a lot of implications about that I haven't thought through.
Yeah.
Surveillance being top of the list.
Yeah. And one of the things that... the reason I think probably we hadn't is because one of the things that led us to consider so heavily the federated model was the fact that we wanted to address some of the concerns around aggregation. And so by having the two, we don't address the issues that people came up with us about. Single point of failure wouldn't be an issue because you'd have the two, but the aggregation and security risks and privacy. Someone cracks the one system with everything in it. Stephanie?
I actually think this proves you don't listen to me, Fab. I think we did discuss this. And one of the problems from a privacy perspective and a trade perspective is you're basically setting two classes of requester, understanding that law enforcement is different, but then you're throwing the civil law enforcement folks into different jurisdictions where they may get differential treatment, and that's going to become an issue over the years, I'm sure, as more economic activity takes place on the internet. It also doesn't solve the privacy problem because you will be exposing people to that type of inquiry in varying jurisdictions without protection.
So we've noted your, we'll go back and look at it. Steve?
Yeah, just one question about that. As I read these charts, under the federated model, the RDS would still handle, I mean, all the auditing. That would still be centralized. It would be centralized in a different place than the data was, but you would still centralize the administration of the gating system and issuing credentials and auditing. So if there, I'm just not sure what would be gained by this mixed system, because the real question is, what are the auditing rules for different users? Would you have different auditing rules for different users? But if they were administered in one place, it doesn't necessarily matter whether that's also the place where the data is stored. At least that's my
correct.
Understanding
that's,
of the federated
system.
That's why
we did what we did.
Yeah.
And I wanted to note, obviously we note it and think, because it's an interesting concept that I think maybe it's just worth, you know.
So if I can come back then, sorry, this is the one bit of the report I haven't read well enough then. I think that you ought to consider a slightly different model where the RDS is used as a lookup by the GTLD registry of the federated, of the person. So someone comes to the registry to get the data, okay, and they are then, you then go back to the RDS to double check about things. Do you see what I mean? So rather than it be the gateway, which I think I understand now, for the way that lookups are then spread out and things like that, it is used, you know, in reverse. Does that make sense?
Yeah. In some respects, to me, yes, but I think then you lose some of the other benefits of not having to find every registry when you do something, especially if you're doing a search. Say I'm looking up a bad guy who goes across multiple registries. I'd prefer to go to a one-stop shop who does the work for me, and then as opposed to going to each registry and have that registry check my validation. What is your concern that data is flowing up to the registry?
No, it's about the centralized audit trail. What you've described as a federated system is actually still a centralized system. Yeah, it is. You haven't actually got away from a centralized system here.
We have, insofar as that we don't aggregate everything in one place and make a copy.
But you know, metadata is actually as important as data, and this is centralized metadata here.
Correct. We don't get away from process and transport.
But in many of the debates about surveillance that have taken place recently in the media, people have been saying, oh no, we didn't actually look at any data, all we did was look at metadata, okay? And people are just as upset about metadata being looked at as a data being looked at. And so you've actually got a hybrid model here of centralized metadata.
So if I might, I think actually what your concern is that you want to have a different portal with a different set of policies around it, and that's actually separate from where the data is stored. And it's an interesting thread to follow, but I think that's what your concern is that you want the access to for a certain set of highly credentialed users to operate under different policy with regard to auditing and tracking.
No, this second one is a separate point, which is that the federated model that's being presented, I don't think really is a federated model. It is a federated data model, but a centralized metadata model. Okay, and that, I suspect, will, once it's worked out, by people will have the same level of objection as the previous model did. But the earlier point that I was making was, yes, that if you want to actually prevent tracking of law enforcement, then you might need a fully centralized data model at the same time. And sorry, I'm not helping you here.
No,
I understand I'm complicating things.
Jay,
more.
So let me ask you something. Would you? I think I understand your concern. So would the solution to your concern be that you go to one place to get your credentialing, and then you could actually just use that token or that credential across registries, who then continue to just offer their port 43 or their just the regular who is okay.
Yes, and that's what I thought I heard you say, that you want a central place for credentialing. But if you do that, you're still exposed to centralized metadata. You can't get away from that. You're not getting, as a matter of fact, that kind of metadata is even more important because it tells me who wants what.
I don't think it would, because if I'm logging onto a centralized server that's determining what my credentials are, all it's doing is determining my credentials, right? And then it refers me somewhere else where we actually make the queries that I'm asking of the database. So in reality, that would be a much more secure model in terms of my information. You're shaking your
head.
Well,
it's not even the security that was at issue here. It's whether or not you were keeping centralized metadata.
Right, but all you'll know is that I logged in. You won't know what question I asked. And what I don't want you to have is what question I asked, not that I logged in 12 times today.
I'm not so sure, because I have to know something to direct you. What would you give me to direct you?
My credentials.
What do I do after that? If you come up to me and tap me on the shoulder and say, "I am me," and I say, "Okay, yeah, you are you."
Yes,
so
I'm getting.
I'll
tell you. I can answer this fairly simply, right? So I log in. I say, "I'm Bobby Flame with the FBI, and I'm doing," and that's it, right? And you know that because I've logged in that I'm about to go ask questions that I don't want to be tracked. You will either send me to some place that doesn't track, and then I will ask my questions. Or you will send me where you send everybody, but it will be include some chit that says, "Don't track this guy," right? So in either case, it doesn't matter to you what question I'm about to ask. All that matters to you is that I have presented my high-level credentials, and you're going to give me high-level credentialed, untracked access.
Yeah, I get that. But sometimes it's the question you don't ask me that tells me more than what you asked me. I mean, if I were surveilling somebody, and the fact that you tell me that you don't want to be tracked, the fact that I know you say you don't want to be tracked is going to give me heightened, need to find you by other means. So I'm trying to make the case, I'm trying to figure out why it is it's important to have the metadata centralized in one instance, but not for the other instance, which is the law enforcement requests.
I'm actually not, whatever the structure is on the back end, I don't care, right? I really don't.
Now,
you guys do it however it is that you want to do it. You guys know a lot better than I do how to do this. What I care about is that I can log in, and I don't care if you record the fact that I've logged in. What I care about is that you record what questions I'm asking. So as long as I can log in and then be sent and then be able to ask questions without my questions being tracked, I'm
so
good.
Can I ask a quick question just to?
Yeah.
If it came in and said, "Hi, I'm Bobby Flame,"
mm-hmm.
"I've got this credential," and all he did, Bobby said, "I'm drop down, my purpose is investigations," and it stopped there and didn't track who you were investigating, does that solve your question?
Why do you want to track my purpose once I've logged in
just
at that
asking.
Level?
Just asking.
So my assumption that actually would probably be fine, but my assumption was that what you were going to do is you were going to credential law enforcement people as law enforcement people, and you were going to credential IP people as IP people, right? And the law enforcement people would be handled differently once they were inside the system than, say, the IP people would be handled, right? So you don't need to ask me what it is I'm doing in the system. I log in as a credentialed law enforcement officer. You handle me one way. I log in as a credentialed IP person. You handle me differently. And the only thing that really has to be handled differently is the tracking at this point and what data I get access to if you guys set different tiers for me.
Okay. Maybe we should start a queue.
Yeah. So start over here. And then Lisa, Stephanie, and Jay.
Hi, my name is Justin Macy. I'm here for LegitScript. Something that we've noticed in all five of the models that are proposed is that it still has a centralized data requesting process. The data is in a lot of places, which is kind of what we've discussed repeatedly, but it still would have a centralized process for processing that. We think one of the benefits of the internet in general has been the decentralization of data and the redundancies in doing so. Is there a fear that having one organization having access to all of the world's WHIS data like that is in some ways monopolistic for all intents and purposes? It's very valuable data.
Do you want to answer right now? So listen, I think that's part of the comments that we received, both from either centralized portal access or centralizing the data generally. That's something that we're balancing out. Obviously, the reason, hopefully it's obvious, the reason that we continue to push towards some sort of centralization from a user policy and systems perspective, things become a lot easier. It becomes easier to manage rules. It becomes easier for users to know that that's the one place. I mean, one of the things that we hear a lot about is, where do I go to find this information? People don't even know where to start. You make it a one-stop shop, they can do that. And then you can start more easily tracking, like, say, some of the concerns that Stephanie's brought up. If we start allowing every person with data to set their own rules or to do something different, let's put it this way, even if we said that everyone had to do the same rules, it's harder to police that. So if we say, for example, you need to credential yourself to get in as law enforcement to get access to special things, it's much easier to police that from a centralized space than it is from, well, everyone should do this, because next thing you know, there's going to be a registrar or a registry who isn't going to follow that rule, and the credentialing isn't going to mean anything, and then sensitive data is going to get out. So that's the perspective we've been looking at it from, and your concern doesn't go kind of unnoticed. Yeah, go ahead.
On that note, obviously this data is used in many ways. There are many companies who use this data. Would this stifle innovation in this area?
We would hope not. I mean, look, one of the things that we've actually talked about, and we actually said this today, was that registries themselves, if in a federated, in the federated model, would be able to open up their own access to either their clients or put up their own portals. So this isn't to do away with people who, for good purposes, offer services around this. We're not trying to preclude that at all. And I mean, I think we need, you know, if we haven't accounted for it correctly, we will. So we were going to go to Lisa.
So I had one quick question of clarification, and then I believe Alice has some questions from the chat room also to interject. The question was, you asked about sort of flipping the model on its head. So in that case, law enforcement would go through the registry, demonstrate their law enforcement, ask the RDS to approve that, yes, in fact, you are. But the registry would still see what you're asking, correct?
Yes, in that case, it's law enforcement. I mean, I was talking about flipping the model more generally, not just law enforcement, actually. Yeah.
So I told Stephanie she could go next. So we need to do Stephanie.
Yeah, I just want to go to this issue of how law enforcement is credentialed. It's one of the big sort of headaches because... And I mean, the easiest thing would be for countries or jurisdictions to have a central portal through which they authorize their law enforcement people and they police it. And obviously, there's audit trails within, except if you had, for instance, some kind of an anonymous credential that would then be at least measured how often you're coming in anonymously. I mean, if you're Interpol, obviously you're coming in anonymously fairly regularly. If you're not, you're going to want to know why, right? So I think we have to figure this out, so it wouldn't hurt to give it your best thought and
definitely
make some
propositions. On the verification and validation, or the validation piece, we need a lot of feedback, and especially from law enforcement. So Jay, and then Lisa.
I think that you are conflating two separate things here, one of which is the user experience, and the other one is which the policy under which this system works. Okay, it was the word redirection was mentioned earlier. As though the RDS is providing a redirection service to simplify the nature of the request there. Okay, I don't think that's something that you should be looking at within the system. In fact, to me, the whole way that the RDS is set up here is, as the gentleman over there said, interfering with the ordinary innovative process of the internet, of the way people do these kind of things. And you need to provide the underlying system there and let other people find other ways of doing it and innovating and do these things. You can't design a single global user experience like this. That's just doesn't work. And I also think it's unnecessary. I don't understand what redirection the RDS would be doing that actually needs the RDS to be there. Is it saying, right, I want a specific data element, and it therefore knows that only a particular types of registry have that data element, and it narrows that? In which case, publish it as a list, okay, and we'll build it into our systems and know which ones to go and look at of those registries, all right? There's nothing there that it needs to do that couldn't be done easier or better by people in their own systems, and it eliminates that single point of failure for the, you know, the transfer of requests through and things.
I don't know who did use the word redirect, because I don't recall I did, but I will say, I guess one of our thoughts around centralizing, aside from being able to set policies and stuff, that would be much easier to police than just saying every registrar and every CCTLD and et cetera, just do what you want, and then we'll just keep it on faith or do an audit on you. Aside from all of that, I think it's clear from community feedback is why ICANN actually took upon itself to try to create a centralized WHOIS portal, because one of the major complaints we get from everyone who doesn't come to these meetings, including many people who are interested in use data.
Sorry, but you can easily create a centralized WHOIS portal without ensuring that the only thing that exists is a centralized WHOIS portal.
Well, that's okay. In the federated model actually says you can create a centralized WHOIS portal, but every every registry and registrar could then decide on its own to provide that same data that they hold to every customer and or everybody. So in essence, what we're saying is exactly what you're saying.
Okay, you're going from two extremes of a spectrum there of the single global portal over there to complete have to build it all yourself over here entirely.
It's a complete mix. What we're saying is that we will offer the one-stop shop with everything in it,
yeah.
And then if somebody wants to offer services on the side, they could.
If somebody wants to build a separate global portal that works that
way
for
global,
the accreditation.
But that's the difference. It wouldn't be global.
Exactly. That's it. That's what I'm saying. You're defining the one and only global portal that can exist in this case. And I think that it's perfectly possible to do this in a way that allows, multiple
global portals.
Okay,
that's a very good point.
I don't want to, not to be a pain, but I don't want to have to be accredited through multiple portals in order to
just
get
one accreditation. Just one accreditation, but different levels of service are different ways it's offered.
Yeah, totally. Lisa, sorry.
Kathy Kleiman has two questions. First question is, Stephanie raises very important issues and questions about civil and criminal law enforcement jurisdiction, scope, and differences. The GNSO committee may not have this type of expertise when it evaluates this material. How does the Expert Group envision this very sticky material being handled by the community?
I didn't hear you well, so I didn't know.
Oh, do you want me to repeat?
I got the important issues, expertise that we may not have. Stephanie, do you want to answer that, or do you want me to take a...
Apart from the joke, you're going to have to pay me to sign up for the next one of these. I think that is a real issue. We're going to have to recruit people who have expertise in some of these issues to join that PDP, if that's what we're talking about. This is the GNSO community evaluating, though, that she's speaking of, so... Maybe that means intense reaction with the committee. Even though I was teasing Fab about not listening, there's hardly a model we haven't at least trashed about for a bit. So maybe that means we're in for another 6 months. Who knows?
Lisa.
Kathy's second question is for Bobby. Is being law enforcement alone enough to open up unlimited use of the database? Are we concerned about what Syrian law enforcement or Chinese law enforcement might do with broad and unlimited access to WHOIS data?
Hi, Kathy. Well, that is a concern. You know, once you start tiering the access, and we have always, I mean, this is my personal advocation that, you know, it always becomes a difficult issue when you tier access for law enforcement only, because we have a lot of operational security folks like Rod here, other people that do a lot of good work, a lot of good gumshoe, which is where we get a lot of our leads. So that's why we wanted it to, you know, we've always advocated at this point for broader access for everyone, not just specific tiered access for law enforcement. Because then you do run into problems, as Kathy Kleiman mentioned. It's like, okay, well, if you have law enforcement from certain countries, which other people may not have faith in, you know, then you do run into a problem, because if they have specialized access, then that does become a problem if they're not using it for the purposes which we, as the FBI, would use them, which is for, you know, law enforcement investigations on crimes based in the United States. So it does become a problem, and you know, we've had these discussions before with, you know, giving law enforcement private access. You know, if I wanted to be selfish, I would be like, yeah, I want the private access, and, you know, we can give, you know, everyone here at the table private access. But what about the other law enforcement that aren't here, or the, like I said, the other advocacy groups who do operational security, who do work on phishing, like the anti-phishing working group, the messaging anti-abuse working group, you know, people like that who actually provide us with a lot of leads and a lot of intelligence and assistance. So the whole issue becomes very sticky, and I don't, that's why we have always advocated, or, you know, as law enforcement, advocated the most robust public system that is accurate and accessible to everyone. And we know that's a different, you know, we know it's difficult, we know it's a lot to ask, but to just be fair to everyone, that's what we've always asked for. That would help us, and that would help, you know, the greater community as well.
Thank you, Bobby. Denise?
Yeah, I just had a follow-up question for Jay. Under the scenario you expressed where we would give the sort of list of rules on gated access for purpose to the registries, and then they would, you know, create the system or build it and implement it, wouldn't the registries be concerned about the cost that goes directly to them to do that, the cost and resources versus keeping that in a central, more central location, okay, or a portal?
I wasn't actually thinking about the registries building that, but alternate providers of this kind of service doing that. Okay.
So, Jay, to your point, as you were saying, so would the solution be basically put out requirements? Yeah, an RFP, or just put out almost like when you do APIs. You know, there's a certain standard, and then once you do that standard, you get feed into our tool. Would you be saying basically have a validator or a verifier who does everything, and if you meet the certain standards or requirements, there could be multiple portals, all of which may have certain nuance, but at base floor, all operate under the same rules and have to use the same verification codes, and
yes,
all have access down into the,
yes,
can do the same things.
Yes, I think when you separate out the creation of credentials, it's once the credentials are done.
Yes.
Okay, yes, then the rest of it, yeah, absolutely, yes, I think it's perfectly possible to do that. You know, because ultimately, if you have a set of rules that says for this set of credentials, only this data can be extracted in this way, mm-hmm, every registry is going to implement that and not trust that to anybody else to do. Even if the RDS is doing that itself, we're still not going to take the risk. Okay? You know, because it would be bad practice for us to move that risk outside of the organization in that way.
Okay. Wow, so Steve and then Lisa.
One element here that would fit into this is the question of the cost model, which I know is something you're seeking, mm-hmm, more information on. But it's one thing to say there could be alternate providers if they all follow these same rules. And if one of the rules is they charge what is charged for who is now, which is nothing, that may have an impact on it.
Okay. Lisa? And then Stephanie?
I think what I hear you asking for is actually multiple RDS operators. And we've been kind of talking about this as the RDS. but it sounds like you're asking for multiple incarnations of the RDS running under a consistent policy and a consistent, or you know, a common authentication and accreditation, you know,
sort
foundation.
Of, yes, I think should recognize that it's perfectly possible for the RDS to exist as a piece of desktop software. Okay, you know that somebody has something there on the desktop that knows the rules and goes and communicates with people, and the system polices it because there has to be something that checks credentials. Okay, the registries will have to ensure that credentials can only get access to certain sets of data. You're not talking about any aggregated limits across all registries that are, you know, that are a meta level there. So there's nothing that stops this being done in a piece of software on a desktop.
The one thing that might, and this is where I was going with my question, was I think you're actually only talking about it in the federated storage model, correct?
Yes, correct.
Because you couldn't aggregate in multiple incarnations
places.
On everyone's desktop.
I'm trying to separate the data storage from the RDS component.
Correct.
There. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I'll send you a diagram.
Yeah, please do.
Show you what I mean.
We would love that. We would absolutely love it. So we're going to, I don't think there are any more people with their hands up.
But very short,
Stephanie,
because of technical reason, we have to stop.
They're telling us to stop. So, sorry, Wendy and Stephanie. I think Stephanie was first. And then we're going to... Wendy, sorry. I apologize.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Quick question, since I didn't see in the skim whether you're considering sort of the possibility of delegation of credentials for access... And if so, whether there are... So I have a credential, but I don't want to perform the who has access myself. I want to delegate it to someone else to do that on my behalf.
If anything, I think we've talked about it from a corporate standpoint, that a corporation might possibly have one credential that its employees use, and the corporation would be on the hook for anything its employees do as an agent. But we've also talked the opposite of that, which is that that might go deeper than just the corporate level. But not that I would get it, but I could hand it to somebody else.
Well, no, and I appreciate that you're tying that consideration to the sort of contractual restrictions.
Correct.
Of
yeah, we want
nobody could do more with it than.
Correct. Yeah,
than
we
I
want
could.
Liability here. And then Stephanie.
My question was actually a follow-up to Bobby Flame's comment on how law enforcement prefers sort of open access for all law enforcement. The only problem is that would be assuming all law enforcement was the same. So there's a kind of fiduciary responsibility, not to mention a data protection responsibility, to ensure that a law enforcement agent from, let's imagine, Rogue State 39 is not going to come in and access trade information, access personal information, hand it over to criminal organizations, et cetera, which may be hypothetical. I would like to think it's hypothetical, but don't we have to protect on that? And that's the argument for certificates and for restricting access.
But to go back to Kathy's question, say you had someone from China, and they're like, you know, we have the procedure that, you know, law enforcement has special access. How would you turn them down, or how would you turn down any type of nefarious police service? The other thing is, people are using the who is like they're going to get all this information. If, you know, this is my personal belief, we need to shut Google down, because that's where they're going to get the real information. I really don't think this constant obsession.
Can we quote you on that?
So,
can we quote you on that? I got this tweet just lined up, Bobby.
This is
FBI recorded agent says they must shut down Google.
So speaking of shutting down, the technical people are now quite over their limit here when they're supposed to be breaking down the mics. You are welcome to stay and talk. We are going to lose the mics now, though, because they need to go. We really appreciate your participation. It's been a very enriching session, very, very informative. Thank you very much. And I think Fab wants to continue in the bar. He's buying everyone drinks. So please keep talking.
And also thank you very much for people on the line, because I think it's not so always easy to intervene when you're on the line. So thank you very much.